Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Life Science Rundown. This is Nick Katman with the FDA Group. Before we jump into our discussion for today, just a little bit about the FDA Group. We help life science companies in the areas of quality assurance, regulatory affairs, clinical operations, commissioning, qualification, and validation, as well as consulting around manufacturing and engineering. We offer three different engagement models, which are consulting, staff augmentation, and full-time employee recruitment. So if you ever find yourself in need, just head over to thefdagroup.com and check us out and get in touch. So today I am speaking with Sal Buscemi. Thank you for joining me.
How are you, Nicholas? Pleasure and a privilege to be here.
Absolutely. So before we jump into our discussion for today, could you just introduce yourself and your background, and then maybe after that, kind of highlight what the topic for today's podcast is?
I can do that for you. I'll try to do it within 90 seconds. I run a multifamily office called HRN, and we've made a lot of investments lately into earlier stage life sciences and device companies. We've had a lot of success with that. This started actually 3 years ago, but before that, I started my career at Goldman Sachs as an investment banker. And at 29, I was doing a lot of distressed real estate deals. I was working with a lot of real estate families. And over the years, interest rates have gone up, and that's not germane to this, but we didn't invest in real estate really, and we're starting to now because a lot of the real estate families were also very biased on higher rates and they didn't want to overpay for this. So I wound up having to give back a chunk of money about 10 years ago to my investors after we had some exits after the last real estate downturn and, you know, the cycle up. And what happened was I had to send them, you know, hat in hand, sort of say, hey, here's your money back. By the way, we're not going to do real estate for a little bit because it's getting too crowded. And then they said, Sal, what are you doing? And then I remember one of the investors who I had was a life sciences maestro. And he had said, why don't you turn your guns on me and start funding some of these venture life sciences deals? And it was through that relationship that I met other people, including my partner, who at the time was managing $6 billion for the Rockefeller family themselves in life sciences, where we started to see that there is an actual opportunity for people who were not traditional life science investors, but most family offices worth their salt all had a gateway drug to life sciences, and that was through their philanthropy. And the philanthropy was very poorly managed, and a lot of that was very expensive with high expense ratios, and maybe the money wasn't going to the intended target that the donor thought it would be. And when they found out that they could make direct investments into these earlier stage companies run by pedigreed world-class entrepreneurs who have had several exits, it became something of a mission for them that they paid a lot more attention to, because as time went on, we had this pandemic. We've had a lot of successes, but that's only exacerbated the reasons why these people have been getting into these deals. And it's not always just monetarily speaking. It has other things to do that we'll deep dive into this podcast. And so that was the advent of, you know, how we're running a very successful venture fund that's heavily indexed towards life sciences and devices.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned family offices. Can you define what that is?
Family office is traditionally defined or economically defined as a family having at least $100 million in investable assets. And this is usually something that's inherited or, as we saw recently over the past 20 years, a windfall from taking a company public or selling a company. And you receive all these, you know, a lot of money coming in. Some of the earliest Bitcoin investors, if they sold, probably became decamillionaires. So that's what we call commonly in the industry, the decimals, or the 0.001% or 1/1000th of the 1%. The 1% is most of America, you know, if you live on the coast. So that doesn't really matter. That's middle-class America. What we're talking about is people who have over $100 million in assets.
I'd like to be there. So what are the kind of the more attractive industries for those types of investors?
You know, it depends, because a lot of these, and I wrote about this in my book too, which I just happen to have a copy of, called Investing Legacy, that it's not just financial now. It's they want to hold it, but the ones who take the risk are not going to be the ones who are going to take a risk on, say, crypto. There's not a lot of that. You know, that was more of an entry level, get rich quick type of thing that was occurring. And I can tell you, being in Miami for Art Basel, there was just a lot of stupid money being thrown around at it. But these investors are looking today for the legitimacy of two things: building their legacy and also investing alongside people who elevate their status. We see this in professional sports teams, but then you have the others who are like, hey, I want to make a difference. And my epitaph, I would like to have a paragraph written how some of the different things that I decided to do yielded in the ability to save 1 million lives a year due to cardiac arrest. And that's exactly what we were able to produce to our families. And actually, one of our companies in our portfolio, Avive AED, or Avive Solutions, in February was the youngest team to ever get FDA PED approval. So now it becomes a dopamine hit. There's a financial reward, but the dopamine has been hit. And people really like that because they like to go out and tell people too about the things that they're investing into in order to, build their status and their own legitimacy.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the qualifying criteria for these types of investors?
A lot of these investors, I think when you look at the qualifying criteria, they have to be very wealthy, not super wealthy, but they have to be very wealthy and wealthy enough to know that they're investing in something where they might not make any money. Just because we've had a great track record doesn't necessarily mean that's going to continue forever. Trees don't go to the sky, and we know that. But they have to have a tolerance for illiquid assets. They have to have a tolerance for starting companies, and they have to have a genuine, and I mean this in the most sincere way possible, they have to have a very rich desire to learn, to be able to dig in and learn about certain businesses and how they operate from an operating level or from, even their business plans. There's been a lot of people who just like to throw things into stocks without doing any research because people are lazy. But if you're putting in something and you want to make a difference, what you need to do is you need to make sure that you're prepared to do that. And the other thing too, that's very important that a lot of people don't do, is that if you do want to go into this and you do want to do in venture investing and you do want to invest in world-class companies, you have to expand your network. And that comes with a price today. Whether that's joining an investment club or a society that we have called Clavis Forum, there's things that you can do, but you have to get outside of your own silo that might be only stuck still on conventional investments or probably not really on, thinking that venture's too risky, where, if it's that risky, then why are firms like, Goldman Sachs making a killing doing it, right?
Do you find that a lot of these types of investors that are investing in life sciences have a life science background, or are you like, what's the split?
They mostly don't. They don't, but they have the discretionary income to do this, but they have an intellectual curiosity for it, usually because they've been afflicted by some sort of a disease. So if you know someone who unfortunately died of the most aggressive form of cancer, prostate cancer, you're going to be a little more attuned to that. And it really becomes more of an emotional driven cause. And that can cause problems because that causes, people to take advantage of others. But, if you have a strong network and you're making these direct investments because people trust you, then that becomes something entirely different. Most of the investors are looking to make an impact, but they're also looking to get into things that sort of elevates their legitimacy. And there's two industries today that really elevate someone's legitimacy. Number one, investing in space exploration, all right, Elon Musk. Not all mortals can do that. And then the other is, of course, life sciences, helping humanity eradicate disease, cures, and therapies.
How do these types of investors start? Because I'm just imagining the type of investor that has $100 million available for investment. They're already doing something, right? So let's use a scenario where I'm an investor. I have somewhere around $100 million to invest in, and now that pivotal moment has happened where I'm looking at life science as a possible venture to get into. How does that start and how does it evolve over time?
Yeah, usually what happens is that if you have that much money, then you're putting it into a brokerage account that is a wealth management division. And that, let's just say it's Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs. And so what you're doing is that you're actually getting looks because now you're an accredited investor at very specialized deals that are coming in that you're able to invest alongside those firms with. And that's what we call club deals. And it's been going on since forever. And again, I write about that in my book, Investing Legacy, how the 0.001% invest. However, a lot of, and you do that, but you also find that, you could find other things too, where you can get a little more direct without having to go through that. And that requires you writing a check directly, you know, to a company or joining a multifamily office like ours, to be able to invest alongside. And then this way you sort of peek over the shoulders of what we're doing. One of the things I like to pride ourselves on is that a lot of our investors are not professional life science investors. And we happen to identify a cycle and we had a great track record and we were able to really run its course. And we have one more deal we're doing with a Nobel Prize winner that we already did a deal with in 2018 for the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine, Dr. James Allison. And with the, you know, with that, people really want to sort of touch the cloth. And so that's, you know, people who want to really make a deeper difference without having to go through their wealth advisor are invited to do that.
I just got distracted because my phone's ringing. What are some of the concerns that these types of investors come to you with from the get-go?
Concerns before investing? The concerns they have, of course, is they have to understand that they have to automatically think if they're going into venture, and I tell everybody this, you're going to lose your money. The good part is you're not going to lose any more than what you put into it, but you have to understand there are things that can happen, extreme circumstances beyond our control. And so far, we've done a great job of just basically sailing past that, thankfully, knock on wood, because life science companies aren't levered usually earlier stage. They're funded mostly by leading families who have done this before and have their own operating family office with dedicated life science people that invest in this stuff. And, you know, continuing upon that, too, is that the other conventions are is that they don't know it, but they want to know who else are they investing alongside. The smart investors will ask, am I with a bunch of guys with $10,000 checks who are just basically, you know, doing this as a, you know, as a Hail Mary? Are they going to be around if things go bad? If SBB goes, you know, dark, are we going to be able to raise more money? Probably not. So you want to see that you're investing alongside people who are smarter and wealthier than you are. And I don't mean the country club guy. I mean families and names and established entities. And that's really what makes a difference here, because these companies are not going to be spending any time with these founders if they didn't have the experience in the first place to be able to talk to, you know, come to the table to talk to a professional venture capitalist or raise money from a multifamily office.
What are some of the mistakes founders make when they're raising capital?
I think it's become a legacy of the Bitcoin craze that a lot of people have become very transactional. And since moving to Miami, I can tell you that there's a huge tech focus here, Nicholas, but people just don't have the bedside manners, and they just come up to you. You could be at a restaurant. You just met them. Hi, how are you? Not even as far into the conversation as we are right now, before you know it, you know, they whip out an iPad and set it up and like, let me tell you about your business. And it's sort of like asking for marriage on the first date. You're in a relationship type business, and people are never going to give you their money first without giving you their time. And I think a lot of people have to understand that, and that there is absolutely no entitlement that any founder has to any family or any investor's money for that matter.
That was a really interesting comment. I like that. Nobody's going to give you their money without them giving you their time.
First,
I'm curious. So how would a founder that is in a situation where they're talking to an investor and they're not getting the access to the time that they feel is appropriate, are there any tactics and strategies that they can use in order to get them to be a little bit more trusting so that they can move toward marriage, as you put it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I spend a disproportionate amount of my time doing this. And to me, the communication or the interactivity is the new currency. And if you're spending time by like sending emails out to people and just following up and doing things that your competitors are not doing, that's going to add a tremendous amount of value, because people do, if they do meet you, you have to understand, if they give you their email address, they are quietly a fan of yours, unless, you know, they just totally opt out. But spamming them is not going to work. But just staying on top of them for about 30 days, talking about the process as it goes along. Unfortunately, you know, with every founder, and, you know, I've been guilty of this in my youth, you know, only goes out to raise money when they have to. And then, you know, it becomes much more of a prohibitive process because you have the emotional toll of trying to push an investor to close something or, you know, close very, very soon. But I think one of the things you can do is that you can just, you know, a lot of founders, what they don't do is that they don't put deadlines and reasons for that. And I was talking to a CEO the other day. I said, well, when do you need the money by and why? And he said, I need it by, you know, I think August 1st or something. I said, that's what we'll say. In this tranche that we're investing for, it's going to be for this trial or whatever, this development. We have to close. Money has to be in by August 1st to start the trial. That's when the trial starts. And I think when you start using, you know, some sort of top cover, if you will, talking to investors, you'll get them, you know, within reason, and you're not trying to take advantage of anyone, you're going to find that you're going to get more responsiveness. But you have to spend time courting your investors like you're courting spouse. That's really what it is. You're courting spouses. This past weekend, I was in Miami Beach courting a few people, you know, talking to them. They want to see you, smell you, and then follow up. I gave them a copy of my book, you know, and, you know, the relationship moves faster that way. And that's really what you want, because these people are your assets. You know, your relationship and your reputation are your biggest assets in today. It really is. Because think about it, who has all the persuasion and influence in the world are the influencers, right? Mm-hmm. The Instagram or the political, whatever influencers, they command your attention.
One of the things that I do see, I don't know if often is the right word, but if we could choose a lesser degree of that word, every so often, I suppose, is people saying, I'm going up for funding for whatever series. And then, you know, that period comes and, nope, we're still working on it. And then the next period comes and, oh, still working on it. So there's a good amount of people out there that are struggling. In that spot, what would you tell them? What's a nugget that they could leverage today in order to try to move?
Yeah,
the ball?
So that's a very good question. I actually, if you go to callingthecapital.com, there's a free download, and I have 20 ways to be able to do this without sounding desperate. It's also available on Amazon as well. And since moving to Florida, I've been asked that question many, many times, Nicholas. And the first thing I would do is I would just put, you'd have to separate it into tranches. And what you do is when you're raising capital, you want the first money in the fastest, so you're going to reward them the most, right? So anyone who comes in afterwards is going to get the equivalent of crumbs, and you have to structure it that way. So maybe if, you know, if I was to think about this aloud, what you can do is you can say, okay, we're going to structure this where everybody gets, like, you know, warrants and maybe board advisor, you know, board observer rights or something. Top heavy, that doesn't cost you anything, but feels like a huge premium to your investors, right? Because they can go out and tell their friends, which they will, that they're on the board of advisors of XYZ company, okay? And because to them, it makes it sound like that they're a big sophisticated investor, and they're smarter and more attractive. Really, this is really what it looks like. And what I would do is I would just make it that way and then have a deliberate cutoff. Now, remember, we were talking about interactivity before. So when you're sending these emails out, you're sending good news. By the way, deadline, by the way, deadline. You know, that's much better than saying if you don't raise anything. And a lot of open-ended hedge funds have this problem too. I was talking to a guy in New York the other day, is that if you don't gate it somehow or you tranche it, then, you know, you're never going to get their attention again. And you have to remind them every time you get their attention. Not so much that, you know, you have to look at, like, QVC, for example. You know, they're always using urgency. They're using timeout and everything. They're a multi-billion dollar company for that reason. I'm not saying you have to be the same, but you have to treat your investors gently and be able to persuade them, like, this is it. And I think one of the things that we're doing, you know, is that we did a deal. We're doing a second deal with this Nobel Prize winner. And one of the things we're going to give away is called the deal toy. And it's basically going to be a Nobel Prize made of, like, I don't know, stainless steel or whatever, with the name of the company and the date of funding. Now all of a sudden you have, you know, but only first tranche investors get that. The second tranche investors, I mean, you're still going to get a good return, but, you know, you're not going to get the goodies. And when you start looking at it that way, where you're trying to really get to what you're, investor really wants is an elevation of status somehow, you're going to win.
That's really good. Is there anything you want to add to that?
Besides that, what I would do is when we're raising money, one of the other things is the deal toys are very important. I would also probably stay away from doing, when you're doing these types of raises, and this is more preventative, I would stay away from doing anything on crowdfunded sources, because crowdfunded or crowd is never synonymous with smart. And it sort of degrades the value of the raise. I hesitated before saying this, but this is important because a lot of people come to me and they'll say, yeah, and then we're also going to put it on one of these crowdfunded strides. Great. Now you just put it on the Walmart shelves or Dollar General. And that's not what we want. We don't want that investor. And it just shows that you're desperate for cash.
Interesting. Let's talk about the concept of a founder's board and the importance of that. Can you comment?
As an investor and a financier, you look at the capitalization table as being the soul of the asset. That tells you who's really on there. Are they really well equipped for this investment or not? The board of advisors to me is the company's conscience. And who you choose to be on that board is a reflection or a lengthened shadow of you. And you don't want too many weirdos, you know, just because they're giving you money to be on your, I mean, this is like your management board. You'd want to keep it very straight and plain vanilla. I would also make sure that when you do ask these people and you are working with them, you have to have a laundry list of what, because you're going to be giving them, of course, advisory shares, perhaps. But you're going to have to tell them, look, this is what I demand of you in our relationship. And I need you to post this, Nicholas, all over your LinkedIn. Okay. I need you to provide value here. And a lot of times people are like looking to borrow someone's name or resume or pedigree, but there's no value extracted. And I never, and that just drives me nuts. I'm like, how are these board of advisors working with you? Now, like, they should be championing your emails and forwarding them all over the place, because if they're not raging fans, then what use are they? They're just figureheads, and that's not going to get you anywhere.
Yeah, I can imagine. And then just the day-to-day conversations with somebody that doesn't connect business with their heartstrings. I can see it much as a very kind of win-lose type of scenario.
Indeed.
So I've another thing that I've seen in my experiences, I've had the benefit of speaking with founders and board members of companies that have gone public, and they get to ring the bell. And I'm in current conversations with people that are on their path toward that. Can you comment on that? Going public?
Yeah, going public is, it's like being knighted, right? In the UK, they knight you. And, you know, here they let you ring the closing bell of your own company. Right now you can pay a media company to do that, and that's not really legitimate. But I saw an Instagram meme the other day saying behind every IPO is a girl that dumped the guy to motivate him or something to do something, you know, something. IPOs are great. They're not the only exit. You know, if you can get, especially in our space, there's a lot of cash rich pharma companies that are great at, you know, manufacturing and marketing, but they're not really good at, you know, creating the product. And if you can, you know, if you can get those guys to buy you, you probably would get a better valuation, but you don't have to worry about the operational overhead with having to, you know, keep up with compliance and everything on a publicly traded company. It becomes kind of burdensome sometimes. IPOs are great, don't get me wrong. You know, an exit is an exit profit. Nobody ever went bankrupt taking a profit. However, you know, you got to look at it and say, you know, now it becomes a whole other situation. Is it the CEO ready to manage a publicly traded company? And usually that's not it. So you have to start looking for another CEO sometimes too.
Another question I have is, as these founders are looking to attract the 0.001%, what are some of the, and I know there's probably a lot of different characteristics, but what are some of the things that maybe these founders don't know in terms of what these investors are looking for and want to hear? And what are some of the things that they'll see that, unbeknownst to the founder, now just shut that door?
Yeah, so that's actually interesting. And that reminds me to go to a page in my book here where I talk about this. And what we have here on page 147 is the five investing avatars, okay? A guy that wears khaki pants and drinks light beer and only cares about real estate is not going to be investing in that. So don't even ask him about it. Okay. He's not. The guy that I'm just speaking here, the guy that's come into some money and he's looking for legitimacy. And, you know, he's been very, you know, he's already well placed and, you know, other things. That's the guy who's going to be looking to do that. Chances are he's looking to improve his status with his friends. And, you know, they come in many different ways, but we call him the mogul, the guy in the khaki pants, you know, that, you know, who's working on his cholesterol. He, you know, we call him the provider. Then there's the alpha woman, the power woman, and they're more into like social issues and ESG and type of things, because it's sure. more of a reflection of their personality. And the investments have to reflect their personality. The guy in khaki cargo shorts or khaki pants who looks like a football coach on the weekends is not investing in the crypto. He's just not. And that's, you know, you have to know your audience. And a lot of people don't do that. And again, it goes back to me saying before, a lot of people have become very transactional, thinking that just because you have a nice car or because you have a nice house in the Hamptons that you're actually going to sit there and at the kitchen table and write a check. It doesn't happen that way. It has to appear to what makes them comfortable, right? There's people who invest in life sciences because they know it, they love it, they're very deep into it. They have, you know, they have the background too, of course. I mean, some ex-founders of some companies, some of our CEOs are great investors of ours, but they don't know real estate, and they're smart enough to know that they don't know real estate. So that's why they go through us.
Excellent. So I want to touch on your book. Before we touch on your book, I'm going to do a selfless plug. I'm actually writing my first book.
Oh, good.
Yeah. It's called The Passionate Workforce. I like that. It's going to be, it's going to be published in October. So everybody listening, you can mark that on your calendar. You don't really need to. There'll be a lot of promotion on LinkedIn. But just real quick, since we're on the topic, my philosophy is that as leaders and managers, our workers are somewhere on a spectrum. And that spectrum, in my opinion, is passion on one end, resentment on the other. And we've all been passionate at one point in our career, right? And what is that? What type of behaviors do we use when engaging in that? Well, we show up on time. We care about the quality of our work. We're innovative and creative. We're helpful. We're optimistic, all of those things. And similarly, we've all been resentful at some point where we don't show up on time. We don't care about the quality of our work. We badmouth the company and our boss. We could even become destructive. So as leaders and managers, what do we need to do in order to get everybody to the passionate end of the spectrum and keep them there? And my book has 15 pillars that any leader or manager can use in order to assess and remediate their teams in order to get them to the passionate end of the spectrum and keep them there.
That's really some good deep EQ that America could use right now.
Yeah. So that's my book.
Emotional intelligence quotas. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my awesome book that's coming out. So everybody stay tuned. Don't change the channel. More importantly, can you show us your book again and explain what people could benefit from?
So this is my third book, Investing Legacy. And I published it through Beverly Hills Publishing in Beverly Hills. And it's a book that's written for people who have come into their own, but they really don't know how to navigate what it is. And, you know, it was written because there were several, I'll just tell you, a lot of women who would call me and they say, "Hey, Sal, I read your investment letter. Sounds great. Congratulations. But I have no idea what the heck you're talking about." And, but, you know, when we were on, when we were out the other night to dinner with Bryson, you mentioned that you were working with a family in Southern California to put a name on the side of a library. And now I got their attention. And so, you know, with all these questions that I've been asked over the past, you know, almost 20 years now, as much as I hate to date myself, put it into a book. And I would come out and I talk about some pretty outlandish things, but I would also have other people corroborate it. For example, ex-bosses at Goldman Sachs, or I sit on the board of advisors of a company named Genius Biotechnology in Boston alongside Stephen Rockefeller. I have him quoted in the book. So, you know, this sort of adds a lot of social proof to a lot of the things that I'm talking about, because people would always ask me, are these people investing in crypto? And I'm like, no, they're not. You know, that's not what they're after right now. They're not looking to get rich quick, right? They're not investing in meme stocks. They don't have to get rich. They're already rich. Now they have to not just hold on to it, but they want to see how they can extend that through several generations. And I actually wrote this book because, you know, a lot of people have asked me, like, well, does everybody drink cherry Cokes and eat hamburgers like Warren Buffett? I said, of course not. You know, he's a documentarian. Again, I get into the five avatars in the book. If you go to investinglegacy.com/book, I'll send you an autographed copy of it. That's investinglegacy.com/book. I have 20 of them upstairs in my apartment. So, you know, I can't wait to, you know, to share that with you guys. But it's also available on Amazon. I did narrate it myself as author. And that's actually a cool thing to do. And I would suggest you do the same thing, Nicholas, because not only do you want to give people different modes of ways to listen to it, different modalities and mediums, but a lot of people actually say that they can actually resonate more with you knowing that it is you, you know, with that book, like you're sort of like in their heart.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that I'm going to do that, but I appreciate the suggestion.
It's okay. It's okay.
Follow-up question on your book is, what is the profile of somebody that could benefit from that book? What do they look like?
Someone who has recently come into their own with an inheritance, who is not looking to get rich quick, who has matured perhaps from day trading and you know, and flipping stocks or crypto or something, and they're really looking to build a legacy for themselves. And today, that's really the, you know, the status today, I think, what people are looking for is immortality, right? Whether your name's on the side of a building or, I mean, look at Michael Jackson. He sold more records after he died post-mortem than right before, you know, the 10 years prior. It's sad, but it's true. And that's what people are looking for today, especially in this AI-generated world where you can have an identity that's just perpetrated as an avatar forever. Mm. And a lot of people are catching on to that. Now, I went a little deep there, but if you're looking to preserve your wealth beyond three generations, this is a book that you want to read because it sort of tells you why people invest in professional sports teams rather than single family rentals. Does that make sense?
That's awesome. Also, I'm an avid reader and learner. And when I think about money, there's three books that I think of. And then I'd like to hear what other books you find interesting that you'd like to promote. One is Tony Robbins, Money Master the Game. I think that's a very basic for anybody that, you know, needs to learn more beyond their basic 401k. I think that's a really good book. Anybody that's interested in getting involved in private equity, I read the Private Equity Playbook, which I thought was really good. And then there's I think this book's actually somewhat new, which is really cool, is The Psychology of Money. And the interesting thing about that is the author explains that you can make bad business decisions or financial decisions, but they're good because they help you sleep at night, right? So he came up with an example about how his stocks and bonds are 50-50, and conventional wisdom tells him not to do that, but he's investing so that he can sleep at night. So that was kind of a unique approach, because sometimes I think we all, to different degrees, say, well, you know, I really want to do that, but it doesn't sit right with me. Or they're telling me to go this way, but it's not sitting right with me. So anyway, those are just some that pop in my head. What are some other books that you think would be helpful?
I think if people really want to go down the route of really understanding if they have the money to invest in this stuff, is an old book, and it talks about how all the old investment banks were started, and you know how Goldman was started. But it gives it in a very interesting critique, and it's written in 1968, and it's called The Merchant Bankers. And this is the advent of like the real gentlemanly risk takers in Europe, and all the wealth that they had accumulated being merchants, right? Goldman was selling window panes before they went into finance. Lehman Brothers was trading grain, right, and cotton, and they were merchants, and they started making venture capital investments into things and industry the way it is today. And it's a great history, but it also teaches you the value of character, and you know, the ethics, you know, that these investors have, you know, when they're working with other people's money, financing things from from companies to unseating kings, right? And it's an interesting story, but it's a good cultural reset for people who are interested in playing in this space, what sort of the rules of engagement are, besides, you know, my book too.
Excellent. Well, this has been super helpful. Before we close, what would you like to leave the audience with?
I'm going to tell people, especially new entrepreneurs, not to get discouraged, and that entrepreneurship is really self-development in disguise. And you need to really be focused on developing yourself, whether you're a professional investor. I read books all the time. Not only do I write them, but I read them. But also you want to make sure that you're spending quality time with people who really have your best interests and who can help elevate you too as well.
Yeah.
Things are going to get kind of interesting over the next 12 to 18 months. But I think after that, people are going to start to see, you know, the green shoots are going to start sprouting again. The IPO markets will be coming back. Or mergers will be coming back. But it's just, you have to remember you're playing the long game here, and nothing of any value is ever created overnight.
Yeah. And if people want to find you, what's the best way to find you?
They can go to salvatorebuscemi.com. S-A-L-V-A-T-O-R-E. Buscemi, like the actor, my second cousin. But if they want to send an email to me, they can send it to sal@investinglegacy.com. That's Sal, S-A-L, your pal Sal. @investinglegacy.com. Sal@investinglegacy.com.
Excellent. Well, Sal, thank you very much. And as always, if the audience finds conversations like this valuable, please share it with a colleague or your professional network. If you haven't already, subscribe to get updates of new episodes at thefdagroup.com/podcast and follow the FDA Group on LinkedIn. If you'd like to connect about project or resource needs, head over to thefdagroup.com to get in touch. Or feel free to connect with me personally on LinkedIn. So thanks so much for tuning in, and we will see you next time.